No one's going to say that to most Americans, certainly not Tucker Carlson.
Welcome to Politicology. I'm Ron Steslow. This is our weekly roundup where we invite a rotating panel of experts to discuss the truth you need to know behind the most important stories of the week and how they are shaping the political landscape. Joining me today are Mike and Molly, and we are not recording from a train in Ukraine.
It sounded like a Dr. Seuss intro there. Mike and Molly,
are you on a train? Will you from the plane?
Senior advisor at the California Latino Economic Institute, my fellow co-founder of the Lincoln Project. That's Mike. He's now a senior fellow at the UC Irvine School of Social Ecology. Mike, how's that going?
It's going great. That's a lot of senior fellowing going on there in that introduction. Senior than fellow, probably. But the School of Ecology is doing some really remarkable stuff on political demography and kind of focusing on sort of these areas that balance between both parties. I'll be talking about that, kind of look ahead later. So really exciting stuff we'll be talking about on the show later.
And that other voice you hear is Molly McHugh, the one and only. Molly's a writer and researcher of Russian influence and expert in information warfare. Her excellent writing has been featured in Politico, Wired, The Washington Post, Lawfare, among many other publications. She's also an adjunct professor at Georgetown and the lead author of a great newsletter called GreatPower.us. Molly, so good to have you back.
Thanks for having me. Good to see you both.
Up first this week, the Republican Party continues devolving and makes a mess all over the Capitol this week. We'll take a look at that. Then we're going to take a look at Tucker Carlson's trip to Russia to be Putin's mouthpiece and how we're thinking about information warfare heading into this election. Then we'll find out what other political developments our panel are paying attention to and why. Finally, our amazing Politicology Plus members will join Mike and Molly and me for a close look into the money raised into and spent from the array of presidential super PACs supporting the primary challengers to Donald Trump and what that spending data can tell us about how GOP strategists have approached running against Trump. If you're curious about why that matters, but you're not yet a member, which by the way means you're missing about 30% of the episodes we release each week, you can hear more from our brilliant guests each week with a Politicology Plus membership, which is your all-access pass to everything we publish, and you get it all ad-free, and you'll be joining a brilliant, thoughtful group of listeners who help keep this show going. To get your members-only podcast feed right now, go to politicology.com/plus, or just open up the show notes for this episode in your podcast player and click the link right at the top. The Republican Party has continued to devolve, and the nuclear fallout has been hitting Capitol this week. The long, long-awaited border deal for Ukraine aid fell apart because of pressure from Donald Trump and defections from Republican senators. Mitch McConnell's MAGA critics in the Senate are rattling their sabers once again as he thinks about running again next year to keep his post as Republican leader in the Senate. In the House, which Republicans control, they suffered back-to-back embarrassments in their attempt to impeach Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas and an aid package for Israel. And Matt Gaetz, you remember the guy who led the charge to boot Kevin McCarthy from the speakership, is now endorsing Kevin McCarthy to run the Republican Party. Republican Representative Ryan Zinke told Axios, "I knew that we would have the ability to block the Democrat agenda. We've exceeded my wildest expectations on blocking because we not only block the Democrat agenda, we block the Republican agenda. We don't have command of the field." So let's break down what actually happened. After 4 months of negotiations, we finally got the text of the border bill on Sunday night. President Biden and Senator McConnell both endorsed the plan. The union that represents workers at the Border Patrol, which has twice endorsed Trump for president, also endorsed the bill. But because Donald Trump wants to keep immigration as a campaign issue, because it is so potent, Republicans in both chambers tanked it. Speaker Mike Johnson said on Monday that the bill was DOA in the House. McConnell acknowledged that the border bill would not become law. Liz Cheney ripped into Republicans for killing the deal and said, "On Trump's orders, Republicans in Congress are rejecting the border security deal. They're also abandoning America's allies in Ukraine. Trump and the GOP are losing the war on purpose, in an inexcusable betrayal that will strengthen America's enemies for years to come." Nikki Haley called the move to push border security until after the election irresponsible. And in the House, instead of taking up or negotiating on the border deal the Senate worked on, Republican leadership announced that it was going to be dead on arrival and move forward with a vote to impeach Secretary Mayorkas because he hasn't detained every single illegal migrant. They went ahead with the vote on Wednesday night, and it failed. They weren't expecting Democrat Al Green to make the vote because he'd been in the hospital after having abdominal surgery, but he rallied, made it, voted against the bill, and there were also three Republican defectors, Ken Buck, Tom McClintock, and Mike Gallagher, so they ended up with four no votes from Republicans. Then they failed to get two-thirds majority they needed to move their standalone $17.6 billion Israel aid bill. And after the failed votes, Thomas Massie tweeted that pushing McCarthy out as speaker has been an unmitigated disaster. Quote, all work on separate spending bills has ceased. Spending reductions have been traded for spending increases, he continued. Warrantless spying has been temporarily extended. Our majority has shrunk. An unmitigated disaster, Mike, I think is the best way to put this entire thing. But now Republicans are for open borders, which was not on any of our bingo cards. So I think the best question here, politically speaking, is border security an issue where you could actually get traction on the idea that Trump is holding it up? And we have a clip on Nikki Haley trying to make exactly that case. You want to roll that, CJ?
They should not leave D.C. until they get us a border bill. And no, we are not waiting until the general election to do this. And it's irresponsible to say that Congress has to wait until a general election because Trump is worried that he's going to lose. There's a lot of reasons we got to worry Trump's going to lose, but you don't sacrifice national security to do it.
Okay. Not her harshest words toward Trump that we've seen in the recent weeks, but is there a way Democrats can turn this around and hang it on Trump as opposed to just Republicans in Congress?
The short answer is yes, but that's not what tactically should be done right now. And the reason why is if Joe Biden, the president of the United States, were to elevate Trump into this fight, he squanders all of the political high ground that he just secured. And I know that's a different take, but the nuance here is extremely important. And as I've been saying loudly from the mountaintop, what's different about this immigration fight is the Democrats don't know how to run offense on this issue, and the Republicans don't know how to run defense on this issue. And this is playing out exactly as I said. So here's what the president should be doing. The president should be going out and making the case for the policy solution. This issue is where he is weakest. He's weaker than the economy. He's weaker on foreign policy. This is the worst issue for Joe Biden. And so he's going to have to secure a solution and fix the problem before he fixes the blame. I'm not saying there isn't a time to run offense on Trump, but right out of the gate is not that time. Let the Republicans fight. Let them knife each other as they've already begun to do. Don't step into the middle of it and immediately partisanize it and elevate this fight to make it Trump versus Biden. That's what Donald Trump wants. Don't give him what he wants. Go and say, fix the border now, blame the congressional Republicans, and let them fight between Donald Trump. Once you make this Biden versus Trump, as the president erroneously, in my estimation, just did, you literally sacrifice all of the political leverage that you just built into this process. And it drives me absolutely crazy, but it's happening because, again, Democrats have not been able to run offense in 30 years on this issue. And Republicans, I'd say they don't know how to run defense. They don't know how to run anything right now. And why the White House is helping them is beyond me. Like, unleash the cavalry, charge down the hill, divide their ranks, swing your swords, open the cannon, and just decimate these guys. But no, they just squared up the field again and said, this is between Biden and Trump. And it's maddening, because if Biden can actually close the gap on this issue, the pathway to reelection gets significantly wider and better.
He gets a hell of a lot stronger. Yeah.
A lot stronger. Yeah. With all the right constituencies that he needs, then Trump is on the defense.
Yeah.
Let him play defense with his own base, with his own constituency. Let the Republican leadership and rank and file in the House and the Senate squirm and hand wring and stab each other in the back.
Well, and embarrass themselves to their own constituencies if they can't even rally their own votes to pass their own bills. I mean, it's
precisely. You never interfere with the enemy while he's in the process of destroying himself. And what has happened is the White House has given them equal footing again. They've literally stepped in and said, oh, this is about Trump blowing up this deal. And Trump was on stage saying, blame me. Blame me. I dare you. Throw me into the briar patch. Yeah. I dare you. I dare you. And they did it. Like the White House, Biden just goes right out and does that. I'm like, who's... And again, it's because Democrats don't have... I'm not saying they can't also reclaim this ground. But as I've been saying for months now, the biggest dynamic in this debate, this fight that's different, is the Democrats have no idea how to run offense, and that's bearing out. And the Republicans have no idea how to run a defensive position, also bearing out for bigger issues, bigger reasons.
But it was a very strong position, though, for Biden last week to just say, send me something. Go on, send me something. This is your job.
Say it again.
Yeah, say it again. I'm waiting.
Yeah.
But while I'm waiting, look what's happening at the border. That's right.
I would go to the border and say, let's stop this today. Yep. Give me a bill and I will sign it now. This bipartisan compromise that we've come to, we can stop this crisis today. And that, leave it at that. Just keep running offense on the policy. Fix the problem, not the blame. There will be plenty. Let the other Republicans blame Trump. Don't elevate him to the stature of the president on this.
I mean, okay, we're laughing, right? At the incompetence of Republicans clowning themselves in Congress, but the inability to actually get a deal done is having a real impact in the war in Ukraine and on Ukrainians fighting for our values, as we've discussed many times. So, can you talk about that?
It's so painful to watch all of this for all the imagined reasons, but it's also really hard to see. This is sort of the end process of darn near 40 years of the GOP turning themselves into this strange totalitarian party. And it's so bad for the country. It's so bad for, I mean totalitarian as an internal thing, but it's bad for the country. It's bad for states. It's bad for cities and municipalities. And we're seeing that play out in countless ways on issues that I don't want to have to care about most of the time. Because I am selfish and just want to think about foreign policy. But watching what it's done in Idaho and other places that I care about is pretty, it's pretty amazing that when you decide to stock your national caucus full of zero-sum clowns, you suddenly can't get anything done, even amongst yourselves. And I think what Mike was just saying in terms of why is it that the Democrats can't effectively use divide and conquer in the same way that the Republicans have managed to do, even while they are atomizing as a party, is actually quite a significant question. And it's a moment for someone to step into, folks, in the Democratic Party. On this bigger question of what is this actually doing to us, it's that the clip you played earlier of the inexcusable betrayal is, I think, really the point we need to be focused on. And I'm working on a piece that hopefully will be up on Saturday that is essentially about this thing where no one seems to be very focused on the fact that the war in Ukraine, meaning Russia's war against Ukraine, meaning Russia's war to finally destroy the concept of the rules-based international order that emerged from World War II, is the last war in the foreseeable future where the United States gets to win stability. Like, all this other crap we're doing right now is just defense. It is batting down the whack-a-moles of disruption and chaos that a variety of adversaries are taking advantage of the moment, because we have shown we don't want to be anywhere doing anything. We just want to be here setting ourselves on fire. And until we can project a different image on any singular issue in the world, but particularly on Ukraine, if we cannot show that we will back an ally and defeat an adversary in a very clear-cut way,
then all the stuff is going to keep getting worse and the disruption is going to get worse. And adversaries like Russia, who know how to do things like weaponize immigration and have been using migrants to flood all sorts of places where things are bad, are going to see the disruption and the chaos and find moments to continue to exploit that. And there are so many, and we'll talk about this more later, I think, in the show, but there's so many places where there is just fertile ground for getting the brainworms into Americans and making us make bad choices about our things, our lives, our policies, how we are voting, how we are perceiving ourselves and the threats against us. We're just failing ourselves right now as a nation on every single aspect, foreign and domestic. And for me, this is this critical point where we can actually regain momentum. And the fact that Congress can't say that, that the White House can't say that, that nobody is clear about doing it, that even people like Mitch McConnell, who have been good on this and have tried to get the work done, are kind of like, people can vote however they want, whatever. Like, this is really the point that we're at, where we know how important stuff is, but nobody is going to actually try to do the work to get the work done. It's pretty mind-boggling to me. And I think we really need to, all of us, it's not just a Republican problem, you know, it's an all of us problem now. But we really need to see clearly what is happening. And that everything we think we're worried about gets 10 times worse if we fail this moment, which is not just about Ukraine. It is also about us. But the Ukraine component of it is so absolutely critical in resetting our engagement with all of these things, if that makes sense.
It does make sense. And Mike, I want to go back to Mitch McConnell and linger just a little bit longer there, because this is something he has understood. Whatever you want to say about his politics, and I think there is plenty of bad and also plenty of good at turns, he has been a savvy operator in the Senate. And I think we should pause here and discuss for a minute this loss for him in the context of the broader rift between himself and Trump and the MAGA Republican Party, because I've sort of seen McConnell as like almost like the last man standing in the establishment GOP, the leadership figure that you thought, okay, hated by Democrats for lots of reasons, but has been at least a stable force on a moderate Republican politics, certainly when it comes to America's interests abroad, and has understood America's leadership in the world and the stakes of failing our allies. He seems now to be, that stability seems to be faltering. We obviously remember Rick Scott's run against him, which was just kind of ridiculous in how terrible it was, how self-defeating it was. But now he seems a lot more vulnerable. And I wonder how you think about Mitch McConnell being potentially the next man, or maybe the last man, to fall in the MAGA's march through the institutions.
Gosh, such a great question. And also, again, why I love being on with Molly with that answer, just how we are failing ourselves. Yesterday was a tough day, just so many pieces falling, and you realize that's exactly what it is. There's this moment right now, if we could just gather whatever Americanness left in our mythology is to move forward in Ukraine and start prosecuting a case for the world, we could reclaim ourselves. But we can't. We can't even get these votes off of the floor. And there's no question that this was a test of McConnell's leadership. That's exactly what this was. Just by floating and putting the idea out there that this deal was there, and then leaving Lankford, who was the negotiator on the budget deal, out spinning, out twisting, and then backing off. McConnell backing off within moments. He looked feeble. It's like the master of the last master of legislating had been drawn, you know, cornered and checkmated. And it's a very significant moment, because he is the last one holding the barbarians at the gate. And he was doing it through his mastery and knowledge and relationships. which aren't serving him anymore. He can't deliver a deal to fund the fighters of the free world. I mean, well, if he can't do it, who can, when so many in his own party are basically saying, we want to move in a different direction here, a dangerously different direction. And so, yeah, I think you characterized this right. Is it's not just a challenge to his leadership. It's the turning of a page in a new era in the Senate, which, you know, was kind of, like I said, the only thing holding back these House Republicans to whatever small degree was some knowledgeable faction of Republicans who were, you know, agree with them or disagree with them, standing up for what is right and good policy and in America's interest. We saw that brought to its knees in this last session. And that's McConnell's not who McConnell was. You could always count on him to pull something out of the bag and twist arms to get the votes. But to bring it up the way they did, let it die so unceremoniously and so embarrassingly, leaving Langford out there to twist in the wind, I think Murkowski said it best, is who's going to negotiate with us? Who's going to be the negotiator for the Republicans on anything? Like, right? Like, why would you, let alone the opposition, why, the Democrats? It's like, whose word can you trust on what you're going to be able to deliver? You can't bring your caucus. You can't bring, it's ungovernable. It's becoming ungovernable, which is unfortunately the end game for a lot of these people in both houses. And yeah, I just say what you will about Mitch McConnell. He could be counted on to professionalize the actions of the House, and what he was moving on and delivering. You could at least understand the game and play the game by those rules. Once he doesn't have control of it, no one has control of it. And that was what was so defeating yesterday, is we are, as a country now, failing ourselves when there's nobody who is actually driving the clown car.
Yeah. There's also,
it's also, you know, I just to weigh in quickly on what the other wonderful MM has said is, you know, I think it's really easy to lose sight of the fact that amidst this obvious chaos, and I think the vast majority of what's happening is sort of chaotic spin, is purpose. And I think that it is not an accident that Ukraine aid was linked to comprehensive border reform, an issue that no one ever imagined could possibly get done in an election year, as like the anchor to sink it. And it just wasted so much time. Four months of this freaking nonsense, and then being like, whoops, well, we're not even, who cares? Like, woo, let's just throw it right in the shredder. Like, it is very hard for me, understanding the pieces that were involved in this, not to see that as quite purposeful. And just on so many different aspects. But also, I think it's worth remembering, during the Trump presidency, the border is an issue they made a lot of money off of. There was the whole $1 billion thing that got siphoned off by whatever friend contractor of Trump, and I don't even know what's happened with that federal prosecution. There was the multi-million-dollar fund that Bannon was raising to build the private border wall. Like, how many politicians send out hourly...
Put that in air quotes, please, Molly, to build the finer border wall. I'm pretty sure that went into his pockets, but...
Yeah, no, but I mean... It's not just that they're raising campaign funds off of their minute-by-minute annoying emails about the border invasion, you know, but there was serious billion-dollar efforts to make money off of this issue. And I don't think it's one that, well, one, I think they want to keep control of it. And two, I just think it's worth remembering that there's like all these other aspects to this that are not just about the election. But I do think this effort to tie up Ukraine support with absolutely unsolvable American legislative problems is on purpose. And there was an understanding that that's what it was when it started.
Yeah. There's one other, you know, side note here that listeners, I think, should be aware of on the McConnell point, which is that Republicans are likely to take the Senate in this next election because they just have a better map. By virtue of the map, Republicans are likely to take control. And those Republicans who will be elected in those seats are not going to be McConnell-style Republicans. So I actually wonder, Mike, if he sees his own weakness, if he sort of bows out graciously instead of actually runs for leadership and loses. McConnell's the kind of politician, I think, that would rather not run if he knows he's going to lose because of the optics of that. But I don't know.
I think you're right. I think he tries to hand the baton over to Thune. But even John Thune wasn't there on this either.
Right.
right. And so does this become a fight between a Rick Scott and a John Thune for the leadership? I don't know. I don't think McConnell and I think again this was a display that he doesn't have control over the Republican caucus. He doesn't. And I can't imagine that he tries to hold out to kind of hold on to power when there's going to have to be another generation of people coming in who are increasingly of a smaller minority that are institutionalists, that are Republicans who do believe that a functioning government is still an okay thing. But you know, we'll have to wait and see.
To Molly's point about Bannon, by the way, he is being sued by his lawyers because he hasn't paid them. And he's arguing that his bank information can't be reviewed because there might be evidence of a border wall fraud scheme in his banking history.
When your criming starts to overlap with one another, using your protection.
I'm sorry, you can't investigate that crime because other crimes would be revealed. What? Yes, that's how it works usually, actually.
If you haven't learned from Donald Trump, always pay your lawyers.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I mean, it's like the number one don't fuck with me rule.
Otherwise, you end up with really shitty lawyers and you lose.
And you lose. And they have all the information that you had to disclose to them to use against you. And they will.
Next thing you know, you got Alina Haba representing you in court. Very costly mistake. Okay, we are keeping an eye on the potential, the likelihood for Russian influence campaigns heading into November. And there's a major story on this from this week, which is that former Fox News host turned Russian propagandist Tucker Carlson flew to Moscow last week. He and his team tried to keep the visit quiet, but news broke over the weekend in Russia. And then on Tuesday, Tucker posted a video on X to explain why he was visiting to interview Russian President Vladimir Putin. And here's a clip of him from that video. It's long, but it also illustrates his ability to weave, I think, fact and fiction together really deftly to create a completely different reality for his viewers. And that is really like worth stressing. Let's listen to this clip.
This war has utterly reshaped the global military and trade alliances. And the sanctions that followed have as well. And in total, they have upended the world economy. The post-World War II economic order, the system that guaranteed prosperity in the West for more than 80 years, is coming apart very fast. And along with it, the dominance of the US dollar. These are not small changes. They are history-altering developments. They will define the lives of our grandchildren. Most of the world understands this perfectly well. They can see it. Ask anyone in Asia or the Middle East what the future looks like. And yet the populations of the English-speaking countries seem mostly unaware. They think that as nothing has really changed. And they think that because no one has told them the truth. Their media outlets are corrupt. They lie to their readers and viewers. And they do that mostly by omission. For example, since the day the war in Ukraine began, American media outlets have spoken to scores of people from Ukraine, and they have done scores of interviews with Ukrainian President Zelensky. We ourselves have put in a request for an interview with Zelensky, and we hope he accepts. But the interviews he's already done in the United States are not traditional interviews. They are fawning pep sessions specifically designed to amplify Zelensky's demand that the U.S. enter more deeply into a war in Eastern Europe and pay for it. That is not journalism. It is government propaganda. Propaganda of the ugliest kind, the kind that kills people. At the same time, our politicians and media outlets have been doing this, promoting a foreign leader like he's a new consumer brand, not a single Western journalist has bothered to interview the president of the other country involved in this conflict, Vladimir Putin. Most Americans have no idea why Putin invaded Ukraine or what his goals are now. They've never heard his voice. That's wrong. Americans have a right to know all they can about a war they're implicated in, and we have the right to tell them about it because we are Americans too.
Okay, that was about a 2-minute clip. And the reason I wanted to play such a long sample from this video is because of how deftly he blends provocative fact with fiction. Because much of what he says in the setup is true. There's some real undeniable stuff there. But then, and that sort of builds trust in this narrative. And then that's when he slips in the lie. It's worth noting that Christiane Amanpour, CNN's chief international anchor, immediately jumped in and corrected him and said, journalists have been trying to interview Putin since he invaded Ukraine and have been repeatedly denied. And then even a Kremlin spokesperson noted that Tucker was wrong, that the Kremlin had turned down many requests for interviews with Putin. Currently, two U.S. citizens who are real journalists are being held hostage in Russian prisons, Evan Gershkovich of the Wall Street Journal and Alsu Kermasheva of Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty, who's a dual U.S.-Russian citizen. And also noteworthy, last week, Air Force General Timothy Howe took over as the head of the NSA and the Cyber Command. And in 2018, Howe led the Cyber Command's National Mission Force, which identified Russians conducting influence operations in the 2018 midterms. They also took down servers run by a Russian troll farm. And the NSA expects Russia to attempt to influence the 2024 elections, and they're trying to determine whether China is also going to increase its activity. We'll come back to China. But there are two sort of big juxtapositions here that I wanted to tease out with both of you. One is about journalism and how it's treated in Russia. You have real journalists getting sent to prison for asking difficult questions, holding power to account, which is the mission of journalism. And then you have propagandists now, like Tucker, getting the red carpet. And the other juxtaposition, I think, is the difference between covert methods of information warfare that Russia has historically used, like in 2016, and now the overt, perfectly legal information operations that we're seeing carried out with media personalities like Tucker. We've talked about the older method with Alex Gibney and Camille Francois. We've talked about that quite a lot. But something new that seems to be happening is this very overt, there's enough public support within the U.S. now on the MAGA right to sort of legitimize this this mouthpiecing for one of America's enemies. So I'm curious about how you see all of this, whether you want to talk about Tucker's trip over there specifically or these two juxtapositions as I've outlined them. Mike, do you want to lead off?
No, actually, I want to defer my time to the expert on this. I want to hear what Molly says.
Yeah, let's go, Molly.
No, I want Mike's thoughts too. But I mean, look, there's one point that I would make first, which will probably get lost in everybody's already quite lengthy commentaries on Tucker's big trip to Moscow. You know, first of all, you had the moment where Peskov, the, you know, Kremlin's box comes out and is like, well, yeah, Tucker is wrong. Absolutely wrong. Like, tons of journalists want to talk to us. We just don't want to talk to them because they're not going to say what we want. And then the fact that, of course, a Russian outlet put out pictures of Tucker and his charming production crew in Moscow, arriving in Moscow, en route to Moscow. And I think both of those things, which Tucker probably also will not realize, are reminders of how this works, which is you may think that you're the special guy who now is the chosen apple of the eye of the baddies, and they do a really good job making you feel special, CC, Snowden, and others. But then they remind you who is the boss in the process, which is exactly what has just happened. And I find that to be quite fascinating, that they're actually too dumb to see how they're being used. But they'll still play the part, because it is obvious for both Musk and Tucker, this is good. His stupid little Twitter thing, when I looked at it 2 days ago, whatever, already had 50 million engagements. And that's the only statistic on there that Musk cares about is, you know, how many people are eyeballing the thing.
This is smart for them, right? Controversy is smart, and they love it. So I think that's a point worth remembering. But I also think, you know, look, Tucker is making himself complicit on, he wants to talk about complicity in the war. He's making himself complicit with Russia's atrocities. And no one will call him out on that. And everybody, well, he's a journalist, but he's not a journalist. He has made himself something different. I think it was an end product of, it was a truth that was going to have to happen, that Tucker would have to leave Fox because Fox is no longer extreme enough. And to maintain the control that he had over his audience, he would have to leave, which he has done and is radicalizing his peeps even more so than before. And the thing that is so frustrating is exactly what Ron outlined, which is, and it's even before the clip that Ron played. It is worth watching, unfortunately, that entire stupid video he posted.
It is worth watching.
But yes. He is correct that this is a war that is reshaping the entire world. He is correct that this is a human disaster. He is correct that it is the world order that we rely on for our prosperity and security unraveling before our eyes. Is he correct that the thing we don't understand enough is Putin's perspective on it? No, but like that doesn't really matter here. I think the point of it is Tucker has become an incredibly sophisticated propagandist, and there was good architecture for this while he was within Fox. There is better architecture for it now that he is without Fox. And believing that this does not matter, and the way that we will all engage with it, which is to amplify it more, to scream about what a moron he is, which is the continual process of amplifying all the bad things that has been going on since 2016, is not going to help anything. We're in a really difficult and challenging position on the information side. And, you know, Ron, you mentioned the change of command at the NSA and Cyber Command. We all know that I was a big fan of Nakasone, the outgoing commander, who I think was really a transformational leader of these institutions, particularly with his concept of what is sort of loosely termed forward defense. And that was, you know, to defend against cyber adversaries, you can't just sit at the borders of your thing and bat things down with a tennis racket. You have to go forward and disrupt, dismantle, erode, you know, in every way you possibly can, the capabilities of your adversaries to come at you. And frankly, if we thought the way that he thought about cybersecurity and cyber defense, about our own national security and national defense, we would be in a much better position, because everything we do is strictly reactive and defensive and does not look at all at the actual capabilities of the adversary and what they are trying to achieve, in my view. So I think there's like so much going on in the space where we've gotten good at cyber, but in the Russian doctrine, information security is both cyber and information and psychological, and all these topics sort of lumped into one thing, which they view as a national priority. And we separate these things into different bins, and nobody's doing the other pieces. Like the cyber stuff, A plus, like not concerned about what's happening there. But in terms of information security, as we conceive it, which is just the informational bits, and psychological defense, which we don't even do in this country, I think we're really exposed. And guys like Tucker are just sitting right in that space. And it's like just RT, you know, 20 years later of, do you just need to ask the question more, people? Just ask the questions. Why isn't anyone telling you the truth? And these guys are really effective at doing this. And we've seen how it has given brainworms to too many Americans on both sides of the aisle. This idea that no one is telling you the truth, capital T, you know. And there is a problem with our news media maybe not being the A-plusiest all the time. And it is, in fact, correct to say that the administration, people in Congress, other national leaders are not really making the case on what the war in Ukraine is about effectively to the American people. That is 100% the truth. And we've talked about that a lot on the show. The three of us have talked about it. We've talked about it separately. And it's a really effective way to stick your finger in the wound and wiggle it around. which is where Tucker is going to get a lot of space. And we all know what the conclusions of his questioning will be, which he was laying out already in his teaser video, which is, this is a really damaging war. We're the ones paying for it. That makes us complicit. Maybe we shouldn't. And, you know, that separates out a whole bunch of different things and leaves out the parts that we really need to talk about in this war. But he's going to do it really effectively. And I have no doubt about that. And it will probably have impact on views about Ukraine at this incredibly critical moment when this deal needs to get done in the United States Congress, in the United States Senate, to continue to provide arms for Ukraine at a critical point in the war. Because right now, they have to shoot 5 times less in a day than the Russians do, because the rearmaments that they were counting on have not come. So, yeah, we're complicit in this war, but right now we're complicit in losing the war. So all the stuff Tucker's talking about, it's a war that's changing the world, the world order is unraveling, it's a human disaster. Right now we're on the wrong side of that. And Tucker won't say that as he buddies up with Putin. And he's not really actually smart enough to understand how his ego is being used against him, which is really sad. And I'm sure all of his producers are having a wonderful time in Moscow, and I hope they get those videos later. But that is, in fact, the truth, is right now we're not on the right side of this because we're letting whatever this political nonsense is stall doing the right thing. And I hope it's just stall.
I have a follow-up question that I'd love for you to answer briefly, and you can think about it while Mike is sharing his thoughts, because I can't wait to hear what he's thinking. But really, it's if so many journalists have, and they have, lined up and requested an interview with Putin, and they've batted them all away, and they haven't offered any, what value, if any, is there in a long-form interview of Putin, sort of streamed on? What value is that content? And is there any merit to Tucker's claim that Americans should hear Putin's voice, which presumably is what the journalists would do? Is the substantive difference in the questions that would be asked, the way it would be edited? I want to tease that apart a little bit. But Mike, I'm dying to hear what you're thinking about all this.
This all goes back to the nature of war itself at this moment in time. And I think Molly did an exceptional job of kind of laying out the parameters of what that looks like. We're in a war. These are acts of war. And we have to start coming to terms with that and understanding that. And the one of the great strengths of American democracy during the industrial age has left this gaping hole in the digital age, which is all of our freedom of the press, and anybody who's got a microphone is a journalist, as long as you get enough followers. And this stuff is extraordinarily effective. And the thing is, all you have to do is be tenacious and continue, as Donald Trump showed, and as Molly said, with RT, the tactic is to chip away at people's confidence in what they know to be right, what they're seeing with their own eyes, what decades of human history have told us, and just ask the question, are you sure about that? Do you think that the media is really telling you what this actually means? I had a fascinating dinner last night with a friend, highly educated, who started asking questions about Russia and say, do you think the media has been telling us the truth? And do you think Ukraine's, this Zelensky guy is really not corrupt? What do you think of the Nazi influence in Ukraine? Oh my God. This is a very, very intelligent person. But there it is, right? It's like there's asking questions which are very legitimate, but then there's like the seeping talking points coming in, which tells you that there's been this consumption of media. And as Molly said, it's no longer just in the right wing. It's especially pronounced in the right wing. But the Russians are really, really, really good at this. And as much as they may be stalled and didn't take even 3 days the way they had planned and told the world, they're winning the digital, misinformation information war out here. Or at least they're making some very significant strides. And that's what this is about is it's not really, I don't think, the nature or the questions of what Tucker asks. It's the fact that he is elevating Vladimir Putin to this level to have this discourse with millions of Putin curious Americans now. Like the groundwork has been laid where enough erosion in the confidence in our own media, in our own government, in our own intentions has been laid meticulously, methodically. And now there will be this other gentle introduction of this other narrative about NATO, you know, being the aggressor here, right? And that's what we're gonna, this is expensive. And why are we doing this when we can't control our own borders? Why are we, you know, financing this unwinnable war? Why is NATO bothering Russia? You know, and because there are enough Putin curious people after a couple of years of really hitting the Republican base hard with this stuff, I think we're going to start to see the nature of this conflict change in public opinion. I believe that.
And let's be clear about what those years of cultivating the Republican base were, because a lot of it was pulled right out of how the Kremlin has built far-right crazy allies all over the place. It is hating gays, all the anti-LGBTQ stuff that the Kremlin has leaned into for more than a decade. You don't want Europe if you're, you know, the country's trying to join Europe and NATO. Europe is the gays. You don't want the gays, do you? Just overtly leveraging this narrative. In the U.S., they've super leaned into the anti-trans. It's the drag queens who are the real enemy bullshit. Tying that into the border, tying that into Ukraine. Like, the way that all of this stuff has been layered and nuanced, which is to exploit elements of overt hate in America. And then with Tucker's guys especially, because let's remember who some of his fired producers were, but layering in the white Christian nationalist traditional values narratives, which Tucker has leaned into a lot in sometimes subtle, sometimes overt ways while he was at Fox and after. And they really hold up all these guys, Putin in particular, and Russia as the great white hope. It's the last white Christian nation fighting for the traditional values and the religious blah, 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 that will fight the drag queens and all the things that you hate, gender neutral bathrooms in particular. And the fact that you've seen Lavrov and Putin and his spokespeople and Russian senators and whoever getting out there making statements about things like gender neutral bathrooms and drag queens just to make us crazy, and that people don't understand what that is, has been so fucking painful to watch in the progression of time.
It's so effective.
Since 2014, but in particular, yeah, absolutely. Since Trump. But like, so wherever Tucker is now with his let's ask questions about Ukraine aid is being built on the hatred of drag queens that the Kremlin has leaned into. And it just makes me want to vomit every time I see it.
I think it's a point worth underscoring that you bring up Christianity, because I just had this long conversation, at least part one of which will be out next week on Wednesday, with Professor David Gushy, who wrote this fantastic book, Defending Democracy from Its Christian Enemies. And he coins a new term in this book, authoritarian reactionary Christianity, which I thought was super helpful. There's a lot of very smart people talking about this now. Christian supremacy is another term. But in particular, authoritarian reactionary Christianity is something he defines well, but the reactionary piece of it is exactly what you're getting at. And I think Mike has talked about this a lot, which is this, it's a countercultural movement. And he's observed this, and he outlines it carefully in Hungary, Russia, Poland, Brazil. And one of the things I thought was noteworthy is that in every instance, while the animating issues are different, in all of them, anti-LGBT rhetoric is consistent. It's sort of a through line in all of it. And I just wanted to underscore that. But I wanted to also come back to that question briefly, Molly, of maybe a simple way to put it is, what is the difference between a long-form Tucker Carlson interview with Vladimir Putin and a long-form Christiane Amanpour interview with Vladimir Putin?
I think in the Tucker interview, there will be some prepared, I am pushing back on you questions that aren't really pushing back on anything, but actually offering a second opportunity to present narrative that is being crafted. It will be the lack of context, right? The lack of critical context of what Putin is saying, because
Look, Putin is a fantastic storyteller. And this is true with the media, where he's not great. Like, he's not the best, you know, on camera ever. Like, he's a weird fucking dude. He came out of the security services. It's hard to get over that. But he's a really good storyteller. And you see it in the way that people who have met with him believe his crap, right? Like, how many American presidents met with Putin and had a moment where they decided they had connected, right? And then realized later, in fact, no, he's just knifing you in the eyeball. But the stories that he's told about himself, which are most likely constructs, right? The story about his dead mother or his almost dead mother under the pile of rubble and his father like pulling her from the rubble and like that was why he was born and blah, 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 blah. Like all of his stories about himself, his origins, the fictitious, I think, oh, look, I have it sitting here from class the other week, but you know, the fictitious autobiography he sort of did when he was elected president, the stories of Putin about himself that all pull on these narratives he wants Russia to believe about itself. We are a great nation. We are the ones who beat the Nazis. No one else defeated the Nazis. It was only us. We suffered the most. No one appreciates our suffering. While we are invading other nations, actually, we are the victim of all. Putin is really good at this, at telling that fucking story over and over again until people start to absorb and repeat bits of it or question it as if it may be a thing worthy of being questioned because maybe it is the truth and we are just not reflecting on the truth enough. And Tucker will not do the work necessary to directly challenge what is construct in this type of interview. And sometimes that is what needs to happen, right? Like sometimes you need to talk with people to let them incriminate themselves with their own words and then provide the context afterward around it in how you produce an interview like this that shows like, here's a guy sitting and talking about how he's killing Ukrainians and stealing their children and turning them into Russians so they don't have a next generation. Like sometimes that work needs to be done, but that's not what's going to happen here. And he's made that very clear. I am presenting you an opportunity to reflect for yourself on the words of Vladimir Putin. And this man is a liar. This man is a liar who is a trained liar, who is trained in the arts of confusing people with his words. And guys like Tucker are not doing the work to do the pushback.
So here's why I think his pitch has appeal to people. And I mean Tucker's pitch. He's promising to offer this entire interview completely unedited, right? Completely unedited, which is not something that CNN would do or 60 Minutes would do, because when those journalists sit down with someone like Vladimir Putin, they're going to edit the material in the most responsible way possible and not allow lies and fables to sort of eat up big chunks of time. And they're going to try and get at the most salient information that he offers as positive. They're going to ask some tough questions. They're going to air the most important pieces of what he says, and they're going to put it in context for their viewers to have a better picture of reality. But you can understand the appeal of Tucker saying, "I'm not going to filter it or censor it. I'm going to give you everything, and you can judge for yourself." And in this moment where it is so difficult to find truth increasingly on the internet, There's something emotional about that appeal. Everybody else is hiding the truth from you. I'm going to give it to you completely uncensored, when in fact, he won't do the work that's necessary, to provide a more real picture of reality. I don't know. Does that make sense?
It makes perfect sense to me. I mean, the through line through all of this is this underlying grievance.
Yeah.
You know, that he's able to tap into and articulate, and it's perfectly transferable to what's happening here in the United States and throughout the world, right? This is not a new innovation. This is the roadmap to to the strongman's playbook for you know, consolidating power, and it's hate is a great weapon, and that begins with grievance. Is we've been done wrong by this small marginal group of influential people who are destroying us and destroying our culture, and if we just rally against that, if we're the bulwark against that, we can rally great you know, nations through force, or you know, through persuasion to build something bigger than ourselves. And that's very appealing to a wide swath of Americans listening to this you know, the Eastern Orthodox Church, which is an arm of the FSB. Yes,
saying
all of this stuff. I saw it in Brazil.
Yeah, that's right. Right?
It's Christian nationalism. And when they, you know, stormed their own parliament building after Bolsonaro fled, basically, there's basically a big church service afterwards with hundreds of people, you know, previously of indigenous culture and spirituality, now Christians, you know, pushing for the removal of the secular satanic government that was destroying culture. And that's it's something primal in us is mm-hmm. human beings that they tap into. But like I said, this is not new. This is age old. And it's horrifying that we can't wake more people up to say, guys, we're not spinning some weird new theory about what this guy's doing. This has been written throughout the tapestry of humanity since the very beginning of who we are.
Yeah.
And
an aspect of it that I think is really sharp, and it's funny because, you know, I teach this course on Russian hybrid warfare, and I'm in the middle of like the doctrine weeks where I make my poor students read all the stuff the Russians write and say, and it's terrifying to go through. But you every time you go through them again, you remember different, like there's sort of different things that resonate based on whatever is happening at the moment. But this piece where the Russians have been really effective at playing, which I think is partially true and now being exploited, but a thing that they talk about a lot is where Western alliances, the EU, NATO, are delusional and failing is the idea that the nation state no longer mattered. And they're putting so much, you know, putting so much focus into this broader supranational structures. And actually that does nothing to defend you in the end. That's the space that the Russians have been good at exploiting on this traditional values thing. You know, yeah, you might want these trade alliances, but when it comes to defending your identity, your culture, this ephemeral word, right? The things that matter the most to your traditions and what you believe you are and what you stand for, you need to have control of your little nation state because that is the only place where you can defend all of these things, define XYZ, right? And that's the space where they're super effective at playing in and have gotten countries that are inherently anti-Russian like Poland to make really terrible decisions by playing in that space as well, right? Like... but pulling on the traditional values strings, the identity strings, the culture strings, and the anti-gay hate stuff has been the most effective recruitment tool for the new generation of allies for the Kremlin. I mean, we talk a lot about the far right in Europe and the United States, but everywhere. Where, because let's face it, most of the world still not really super pro-gay, pro-LGBTQ, pro-rights, pro-whatever. There's places where, you know, it's like zero to machete on these issues still. And those are the places where Putin just waves his little flag. We also hate the gays. And a whole bunch of people who otherwise shared nothing with the Kremlin 5 minutes ago are like, yes, those guys get us. They are defending the traditional values that we care about. And then it's a pathway to other cooperation, and watching how that has worked so incredibly effectively in the last 15 years has been really disappointing. And it happens to have been the same 15 years where Europe, the United States, countries that are more progressive on these issues have leaned into promoting inclusive values in how we engage other nations. And the ability to create that conflict, the Kremlin has also leaned into, of course, but the America is showing up telling you, you must accept gays, and we are telling you that you can do whatever you want. But this not understanding or wanting to look at or believing any of these things is leaving Americans disadvantaged. You know, maybe you legitimately have religious or moral qualms with gayness, with the idea of same-sex marriage, with giving people full rights, XYZ, whatever your things are. But I don't care about that. I mean, I do care about that. But like, I do care if you don't understand how it's being exploited by enemies of America to make you think things that are not true and to make stupid decisions about your own country, which is the whole point of everything Russian intelligence does. Subversion. Getting you to act against your own best interests. And that is happening in Asia, in Latin America, in Africa, in the United States, in West Europe.
using these issues of such simple, fertile hate to make people make catastrophically bad decisions about national security in ways that the Kremlin is laughing at and exploiting to unravel our alliances and the structures that make us more wealthy, more secure, more successful. If you're not willing to look at those things in yourself, then you're part of the problem. You're the thing making America weak. And
stop doing that.
No one's going to say that to most Americans, certainly not Tucker Carlson.
Okay, well said. Let's move on to our look aheads, and hopefully we have some positive pieces of news and observation. Mike, what did you bring?
Well, I don't know that it's positive, but I think it's going to be informative. How's that?
Okay.
Halfway good. There. And then we'll leave it to Sunshine Molly McHugh to bring us home on the positive optimism. I'm watching the New York 3 special election, the legacy seat of George Santos. Let me tell you why. I think this is going to be fascinating. This seat is one of the very few swing seats in America. There's about a dozen or so. It's got a higher than national average of college educated voters, Republican voters. By any estimation, this can be and should be anybody's seat. The Democrats' candidate is running largely on abortion rights. The Republican is running on illegal immigration and border control. This is going to tell us a lot. And, you know, I'm not the person who's the big predictor of saying off-cycle elections mean something at all. I'm not that person. I'm saying watch this race, because what you're going to find out is if that Republican does come, you know, within less than 5 points of the Democrat here, then I think the Republicans have found a pretty good foil to the Dobbs decision in this abortion intensity that has consumed the last few election cycles. And both, but make no mistake about it, both groups are talking to women here with these messages. Democrats are trying to bring back those independent, conservative-leaning independents, Republican women who have had it with the party, who have shown that they've reached the end of the line with the GOP for the past three election cycles, but specifically after the Dobbs decision. If there's anything that can bring these folks back or prevent more leakage, it's the threat and the specter of Black and brown people streaming across the border who are criminals, drug dealers, and rapists. So that's what I'm watching, because the outcome of that race is going to, I think, give us a lot about how the efficacy of both of these issues heading into the 2024 election cycle.
Okay, and the election date is
next Tuesday. Yeah. So what is that?
Yeah, next Tuesday. The 13th, is that right? February 13th? Yeah, it's coming up. It?
Yeah.
It's coming up on the 13th. Okay, super good. And I think very instructive. This one's positive. Okay, so everybody knows, I think by now, we got a brilliant opinion by the DC appeals court, 3-judge panel, unanimous decision. Donald Trump is not immune, under no circumstances is a president completely immune from prosecution after he leaves office for acts while he is in office. Like I said, it was unanimous, 3-judge panel, per curiam, meaning no individual judge signed it. And our good friend George Conway wrote about this in The Atlantic. I encourage you to go read this piece, but he characterized the opinion as unanimous, no air, tight as a drum. They dismantled Trump's claims patiently, painstakingly, and unsparingly. He had a lot of praise for the opinion. And here's why I think it matters. By George's reading, and based on what I've read from, sampled from this 58 page opinion, he says, an opinion that the high court would be hard pressed to write better themselves. Meaning there's really no reason for the Supreme Court to review this decision, in his view. And if that's the case, when Trump appeals this to the court and they deny it, if they deny it, that accelerates the trial timeline, making it more likely that Trump is actually on trial by summertime at the latest. So I mention this because the likelihood that we have Trump campaigning from a courtroom and possibly convicted on this charge just became a whole lot more likely before the election. So maybe at a future episode, we can get into, you know, the politics of, you know, what happens if Trump is convicted, to public opinion. The other one is, and I don't have a whole lot to say about this right now, but I'm right in the middle of listening to the oral arguments, in the Colorado Supreme Court case about whether, whether Donald Trump is allowed to be on the ballot, in Colorado, which is fascinating. We'll have more to say about that soon. Molly, can you tell us about the project you're helping with in Ukraine?
Yes. So, once again, Ron has been kind enough, to allow me to plug a thing here for you lovely Politicology listeners, who in the past have been enormously supportive, on our efforts to help Ukraine. You know, we all bitch and moan about how dumb the politics are, but I think it's always important to remember that there's a lot that we can do. And in particular, for individual Ukrainian soldiers and units, often the thing that is going to help them not die today or not have their unit lose today or advance their objectives in a pretty significant way is real small. And I think that remembering that there's that space where we can be helpful in protecting as many Ukrainians as we can is important. So I think some of you know, and I've talked about it before on the show, in some of my other hats, I have the great honor and privilege of helping to teach Ukrainians on Ukrainian soldiers on a variety of issues. And in that context have made good contacts with a wide variety of units where there is great expertise in areas that I am adjacent to, which some of you know. But one of the units that I have had the pleasure of meeting and getting to know and working with in the past 2 years needs drones. They are deployed right now, which is why I cannot say which unit it is for, because where they are is not supposed to be known. What they are doing is not something that is public. But like all frontline units, they need small drones, FPV drones, to enable the work that they are doing for surveillance and for communications projects. This is not for weapons purposes, for those of you who might be concerned about such things. And so I have offered to help them raise the money they need to replenish their drone supplies. Any additional funds that would be raised would go into helping them finance the purchase of a truck for their unit. I will post more details about that, in our little fundraising link, which I think, Ron has offered to put in the Politicology show notes. If you would be inclined to contribute to that, even small amounts are super welcome. All the stuff goes directly to the frontline support, and everybody who supports it will get, once the aid is delivered, we've been promised a video thank you from the unit, so you will know who it has gone to and who you have helped. I can't put it publicly right now, but in the future we can talk about who those guys are. So not now, but later you can know what they were doing. But it is for a frontline unit. They're deployed right now. They need this equipment fairly urgently. So I'm doing what I can to help them bridge that gap. Any of you who would be willing to contribute, I would be extremely thankful. In the past, you guys have been great at coming to the call. So thank you again in advance if you would be inclined to look at our little pitch there.
Thank you, Molly. And look at that. We closed with some optimism and a little bit of
optimism
and a little bit of agency too. okay, let's flip over to Politicology Plus. We got a great topic. We're going to talk about the money that the super PACs supporting Donald Trump's challengers spent and where they spent it and what that tells us. Before we do, where are you on the internet these days, Mike?
Still on Twitter at @Madrid_Mike.
And Molly.
Still on Twitter at Molly McHugh and on Blue Sky.
Yes, Blue Sky.
Trying to make Blue Sky. I mean, there's got to be an alternative eventually, right? Like someday there has to be something that sticks.
There's a frustrating lack of functionality in all of these alternative platforms. It's just, it is so frustrating that Twitter is no longer Twitter, even though Twitter sucked before. It is catastrophic.
Well, you
now.
Know, this is the, you know, this is the genius of Blue Sky, actually, right? I talked about this on a look ahead, I don't know, some months ago, last year, in that it is a completely decentralized network and you can take your followers with you wherever you go. Completely.
Yes, but they
the
need direct messaging. Yeah.
As
video,
with all tech tools, they'll develop it.
They need
it. Get there. I'm going to set up an account on Blue Sky. I'm not quite there yet, but I will be.
Do you need an invite code? I have some.
Actually, it opened to the public. I think last week or this week. Yeah,
oh,
just a couple
it.
Days ago. So.
Well, that's good. Now I don't have to send people invite codes anymore.
This is Jack Dorsey's new startup, former Twitter founder. I think it's very promising. Okay. That's it. Let's go. All right, everybody. Thanks for listening today. If you have questions about anything we discussed today, you can reach us, as always, at podcast@politicology.com. Whether it's an episode idea, a topic recommendation, or just a simple note about what you thought, we love to hear from you, and we might even use it on an upcoming episode. Also, if you can head over to the Apple Podcast app and rate us 5 stars and leave a review there, we'd really appreciate it. This helps us rise in the rankings so that new people can discover Politicology organically. I'm Ron Steslow, and I'll see you in the next episode.